Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Las Musas podcast. My name is Crystal Maldonado, and I'm the author of Fat Chance Charlie Vega. Today, I am joined by Gabriella Martins, who I know very fondly as Gabby. And on this episode of Musa Debuts, we'll be talking about her incredible debut novel, Like a Love Song. So I just want to say there is so much to love about this book. I love the glam and the Hollywood life and the not so glamorous parts. I love the romance and all of the amazing friendships and the attention to detail, which I just admired your ability to get on that page with like the realistic texting and the dialogue between the characters and the family dynamics, just all of it. I loved it. So Gabby, can you start us off by telling a little bit about yourself and about your book?
Thank you so much. I was just smiling so hard listening to you talk because you are one of my favorite authors, you know?
Stop.
It's true. So the fact that you liked Like a Love Song so much means a lot to me. Thank you.
I really did. I loved it.
So I'm Gabriella Martins. I am a Brazilian author from the south of Brazil, and I've been a high school teacher for the better part of 10 years. I have also been writing books for teens for the better part of 10 years. And then at one point I was like, what if we write a rom-com?
Yeah.
And we're here now. So I guess that was a good decision. I think that was one that made sense.
I think one of your best decisions yet.
Yeah. I fell in love with writing rom-coms, which is funny because before Like a Love Song, I had always written very dark books. I was really into, you know, exploring just how far we are willing to go when things don't work out. But I was already, when I wrote Like a Love Song, I was in a very difficult time of my life. I was super depressed. My mom had just been diagnosed with cancer at the time. So I felt like I already had a lot of darkness in my life, and I needed my outlet to be something different. Mm-hmm. So that was the first time actually I started writing a rom-com. And then things just happened very quickly after that. You know, like I got my agent, and we had an offer for publishing the book on the first round of sub, so which, you know, is very fast.
Very much.
Yeah. So I was talking to my mom the other day. It's funny. And I said that, you know, I was published so fast. It kind of happened overnight. And she said, no, it didn't. No, you queried for 10 years.
Yeah, you've been working at this.
That's not fast. That's 10 years, you know? So I guess.
Well, I am so excited that it happened so quickly because that means this book gets to be out in the world even faster. So thank you, everyone.
Thank you. The support has been incredible and overwhelming in the best possible way.
Oh, good. Okay. So tell us, you talked a little bit about the publishing journey for it, but do you want to tell us a little bit about how the story came to you? Like, how did these characters come to you? What was it that was there like a spark of some kind? This idea just came to you in the middle of the night. Like, how did you come up with the idea for this book?
Okay. So for those of you who have never heard of Like a Love Song, the story is this pop star who is a teenager. She's a Brazilian teenager, but she has found international acclaim by living in Los Angeles and touring the world, singing in English. She is a Brazilian immigrant in the United States. She's lived there since she was 8. And she has pretty much become the American sweetheart. And she also dates the American sweetheart until he dumps her live on an award show that is broadcast to the whole world. And she comes to receive her her award in tears, looking like a panda. So then she becomes a meme. She's ridiculed online and there are a lot of memes. So her PR team, in an attempt to distract the tabloids from talking about that, they get her a fake boyfriend, an indie actor who is very much not sure what's going on with Hollywood. He just wants to do his art, and he kind of thinks everyone is a phony in Hollywood, which our protagonist does not appreciate. And then things evolve from there. I think it's when you follow social media, when you follow especially women on social media, and yeah, it's even worse for women of color, for queer women, for disabled women. It's very interesting, the bias with which women are treated online versus men. So very rarely you will see a man be humiliated in the same way that a woman will be. And I wanted to explore that bias and explore the effects that being exposed to that extent can do for someone, even when technically you've done nothing wrong. Like, you've cried because you were broken up with. Like, yeah, like, tell me one person who hasn't cried when they were dumped, or tell me one person who hasn't been dumped. You know, those are universal experiences. But when you are a woman and you are a celebrity, you are expected to react to those things with grace. That is not really fair. So in my story, and I believe in the real world, even when the men do horrible things, they are not the focus. The focus is how the woman reacted to it. So I wanted to explore that. And of course, it's a rom-com, so it's in a light way and in a funny way. But just because we're laughing doesn't mean we don't have to think about it and think about how absurd it is. I had, it's funny because one of the agents, when I was querying this book, she said, I don't understand why Natalie faces so much repercussion and Trent doesn't. And I felt like asking her, have you ever been on social media?
That's kind of the point of the book is,
yeah, like
she's not the villain. She's very human in this, I thought.
Exactly. Yeah. When I was a teenager, Taylor Swift was criticized a lot in the media for being a serial dater. And I always thought that was so funny because at her age, I remember having dated more people than her. And nobody thought anything of me just because I wasn't famous. You know, the people I was dating weren't famous. So the bias is so funny. And I don't want to say that there's not valid criticism to Taylor Swift or any of the women who are under the media microscope. What I'm saying is that they don't deserve criticism for that.
Right.
You know, like, if you want to criticize Taylor Swift, then you can talk about white feminism, but you should not talk about how many people she's dated. This is her business. How many people she's dated, how long those relationships have been. None of these things are, you know, our business. None of these things should matter.
Especially, and so, with knowing how young Taylor Swift was when she was getting a lot of that criticism. And I feel like that speaks volumes about what society thinks about young women and how, who they date. And it's very misogynistic, right? We don't put this pressure on men. We don't care as much.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that more recently, there's been some more female empowerment on just feeling things, which can be observed by amazing artists like Olivia Rodrigo, who is very young and brilliant. And I just want to say, the song Bruto, it's like she read an article of my book. I didn't want to say anything about it. I didn't want to brag, but she was inspired by my book to write.
I think so.
That song. Yeah. Like, no, but I think what's so funny, like when I listened to Sour, to that album, is that it fit my book so much because my book is about a teenage girl. You know, that's it. Those are universal feelings we all feel that way. It doesn't matter if we are 16, 18, or 30. You know, we have felt that way and we still feel that way. And embracing that is something that I think is very powerful. And it's something that I did not see at all when I was 16. When I was 16, people were criticizing Taylor Swift for having dated more than one man a year. When I was like, I had a much more, my rotation, okay, was bigger than that. And I didn't see anything wrong with that. So yeah, that was, I think it's very empowering and interesting how it's been changing. I hope it continues to change.
I hope so too. And I loved hearing you talk about social media and just how in general we place this judgment on women more strongly than we do on men, because that was a very fascinating part of your book for me. So it played this big role. And I thought you did such a nice job of juxtaposing the perils of social media that, you know, serve as one of the driving stressors for all of our characters. But then it also, you showed how it can connect people. So like, no spoilers, but William and his family are on social media. And what does that kind of look like? And how do you connect with the people you love? And I thought it was just such an interesting commentary on what it's like existing in the world now and trying to juggle all of those dichotomies. So hats off to you, my friend.
Thank you. Thank you. It was very important to me to show that fandom isn't all bad. Like, mm-hmm. Yes, there are these bad things about, you know, how vicious it can be and criticizing people and dehumanizing people once they have a certain amount of followers.
Right.
So I do think it's important to discuss that they are still human beings. We are still human beings, because I think that also happens to us to some extent as authors once we reach a certain level of followers even. But it's important to know that fandom is a very, very important part of people's lives. And it was a very important part of my life. I can, no joke, say that when I was a teenager, if I didn't have fandom, maybe I wouldn't be here today.
Yeah, I feel you.
Connecting with like-minded people. And in my case, a lot because of music. We didn't have Twitter, but we had music forums. I'm totally saying how old I am here. But we connected on music forums talking about those artists that were writing songs that felt like they were writing for us. And connecting with those people. I have a lot of friends that I met when I was 13 on those forums. So there's a scene that was very important for me to write in the book towards the end. I think you know what scene I'm talking about, where we meet two fans. Mm-hmm. Our main character, and their relationship with the main character is not as important as their relationship with each other. So they, these two girls, they have resignified Natalie's songs and Natalie's public persona as something to be part of their life. And I think that's beautiful. I think that's beautiful, and it can't exist respectfully, without dehumanizing the public person. I think that communities online can be life-saving. It's just important to not use this, the fact that you are online, that you are anonymous, to dehumanize and bully and mm-hmm. become abusive, you know?
Yeah. That's exactly, I just wish I could have that like cross-stitched on a pillow somewhere, because I do think it's such an important lesson, right? Like, so fandom, community, friendships, all of that is so important, especially when you're growing up and you're figuring out yourself and who you want to be. But there's also great power that comes with that, especially yeah. as we're all connected, like you said. And so I loved that we get to see those moments that even though social media is, it brings Nachi down, right? Like we see yeah. Natalie and we see how sad she is and how she becomes a meme, but we also get to see her kind of see her fans celebrate her and have these hashtags. And so there is this nice celebration while also there's like a cautionary tale. Like if you use it the right way, it has great power, right?
Like anything, right?
Yes. Okay, so we are obviously recording this before your book is out in the world, but let's pretend just for a little bit that it's your debut day. Like a Love Song has been born. It's out into the world. People can hold it in their hands. So what does your ideal day look like for you?
So I already know what type of food I'm going to order. I'm going to have Thai food. I'm going to have udon with shrimp and pineapples for lunch. And I'm going to have pizza at dinner. Delicious. Brazilian pizza. Okay. If you know what I mean, you know what I mean. But I think my ideal day, so I know I've always kind of been jealous of people who in their lunch dates, they've gotten flowers from their friends. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to wait for this to happen or not. And I am going to order flowers for myself and I'm going to receive them and be like, oh my God, you didn't have to.
I love that.
So I am going to order flowers for myself. And I would just love to see people at this feels a little funny even to say, but I want to see people celebrating my book. Yeah. You know, I want to see people looking at my book and being like, you know what? I saw myself in this, even if I'm not Brazilian necessarily, you know, I saw myself in this, in the way this person grew to accept who they are. I saw myself in this because I felt celebrated as well. So I want to celebrate this book because it celebrates me. Because that's why I wrote it. I wanted to, the dedication of my book is to teens who feel they may not belong, because that's how I felt as a teenager. And as an adult for most part of my life, I felt that I didn't belong. So I want you to read this book and feel that, no, you're wrong. You do belong. There's a place for you in the world, and the world is better because you're in it. So if I can make people feel that way, then I don't care about how many copies I sell. I don't care about, you know, anything else. That's mission accomplished. So I would love to see a bit of that in my debut day.
You will definitely get that, not just on your debut day, but in the weeks, months, and years to come, because you've done such a good job here.
Thank you. Yeah. I hope you're right. I got to be honest with you. Whenever I see people be excited about my book, I'm like, why though? Like, I know I wrote a good book, but why are you acknowledging this?
Yeah, well, you have to get over that and get comfortable with people loving your stuff.
Thank you. It's just so wild because I spent 10 years querying mostly Brazilian stories and being told repeatedly that nobody cared, you know? So I think I'm not trying to be humble. I genuinely don't. Like, it hasn't really dawned on me that people do care.
They do.
So whenever a stranger talks about, like, if it's my friend, I'm like, oh, okay, you're excited about my book because you're my friend, you know, which some of my friends hate to hearing that. They're like, I am a real person, you know, like, right. Okay, I'm your friend, but I still have, like, taste in books and stuff. But, like, I don't care, you know, you're my friend. I'm like, okay, you're being nice because you're my friend. But then strangers tagging me and stuff and being like, you're one of my most anticipated reads. I'm like, why? Okay, why? You know, like, that's interesting. I don't understand it, but thank you. It's really strange. It's really, really strange. Are people telling me they pre-ordered my book? I am so bewildered by that. I'm like, you did? Why? Like, thank you. But you actually bought it? Like, you put money behind it? That's kind of mind blowing to me, because I was told for a very long time this wouldn't happen. So it's funny. It's genuinely funny. I'm not even bitter about this. I swear to God, it's just funny. like my editor telling me she loves my book. I'm like, yeah, I mean, it's kind of your job to love my book.
So right.
It's okay.
I'm glad.
I'm glad. Yeah. Or, you know, the wonderful people who have worked on my book. Like I got Andrea Law. She did the interior design of my book, which is extremely beautiful. And, you know, she's a wonderful person. And when she worked on my book, she sent this very thoughtful, beautiful note about how much she enjoyed it.
Oh.
And I was like, okay, yeah, you worked on it. Like, yeah, whatever. And then my agent was like, no. Like, this doesn't usually happen. Like, she went the extra mile. Like, this, that's not the norm. They don't have to do this. And I'm like, wait, what?
Yeah,
so she's not contractually obligated to like my book, and she did? That's wild. That's bananas.
So, well, yeah. Imposter syndrome is so real, right? We just don't believe it. We don't believe the goodness.
You know, it's funny. Like, I am privileged enough to have grown up with a mother who always believed in me and who always told me I was very good at writing, even when I was definitely not. So I do think I'm good. You know, yeah. I do think my books are great. This may sound arrogant to some people, but that's the way I was raised. I was raised believing in myself, but believing in myself while being aware that the rest of the world wasn't going to.
Right.
Which I guess comes, you know, from being someone from the global South and a queer person and having encountered a number of microaggressions throughout my journey. But it's just really funny. Yeah. Don't you feel that way sometimes?
Absolutely. Every day, girl.
Okay, I'm not alone.
Not at all. Yes, like it's so bizarre and wonderful, but confusing. And
exactly. Yeah, yeah.
It's all of these emotions.
Not that
we're
not grateful. We're just confused.
Yes, it's weird. Like you said, your friends, your family, people you know, you expect them to support you, but sometimes they go above and beyond, like, oh, I bought multiple copies, or, oh, I want you to sign my book. And that feels weird. Yeah. And then when people who have no connection with you, who don't have to be nice to you, are like, oh, I loved what you did. It's like, me? What?
Exactly.
It's confusing.
Yeah. That's very weird. That's very weird. I'm still like dealing with it, but it's very weird. Yeah, I'm not expected. I hadn't expected, like I worked on a work for hire that I can talk about yet, a licensing book. And so I have a different editor from another publisher. Mm-hmm. And she sent me an email the other day being like, I just wanted to tell you that I just pre-ordered like a love song and I'm very excited about it. Like, this is going to be my beach read. I'm going to be on vacation in August and then I'm going to read your book and I'm so excited for it. And I was like, oh my God, this is not happening to me. This is not my life. How is it my life that this person who is a professional in the publishing industry and she's from another publisher, she is being so nice to me? Every time something like this happens, I am so confused and grateful, but so confused.
I hear you. But I think it goes back to the authenticity of it and the fact that you are out there representing and writing this incredible book. And so I want to talk a little bit about Natalie and how we sort of experience her Latinidad throughout the whole series or throughout the whole book. So we see her have this, like, how many, first, I just want to say, how many Brazilian characters do we have in YA? I feel like the number is very small.
Yeah, unfortunately. Even Brazilian authors, right?
Yeah.
This is super bizarre to say, but we didn't have any Brazilian authors until Laura Paul in 2018.
Which is not okay.
Yeah, like, of course, I'm talking about mainstream YA, right? Easy has, and self-publishing has been notoriously more diverse. But in publishing, in YA publishing, in Laura Paul's book, it wasn't even from a big five. Mm-hmm. And so she was the first. And, you know, even then, like her book didn't feature Brazilian characters. The first Brazilian character we have by a Brazilian author was from a translation. So that's even more wild because after Laura Poll, we had Vitor Martins and Lucas Rocha with their books, but their books were originally published in Brazil and they were translated to English.
Okay.
So
this number is minuscule. So exactly, the fact that this is happening is huge. And I feel like the impacts of it have these incredible ripple effects throughout the industry. So that is very powerful. So you should be very proud.
Thank you. Thank you. I just hope that, you know, that will be one day when we can make listicles of like my favorite 20 Brazilian authors publishing in English. And, you know, it won't be just the four of us repeated.
Exactly.
And, you know, it's funny, Crystal, none of us write the same genre.
Really?
So it's not even like Laura Poll, for example, she writes sci-fi, you know?
Yeah.
I love Lucas Rocha so much, but he writes much more serious contemporary books. He doesn't write rom-coms, which I'm not like, obviously these are amazing books. I love his translated work, but I'm just saying that like, I can't even be like, oh, let's make a panel. Let's do a panel for, you know, rom-com Brazilian authors.
It doesn't exist yet. Like, it's just
me there. And they're like me talking to myself, me and three mirrors.
Right. So,
yeah. I really hope that in the next 10 years, you won't be able to name all the Brazilian authors publishing YA.
I hope because so too.
We have a huge, huge Brazilian and American Brazilian population in the United States. The fact that that doesn't translate to books available, especially for teens, is a nightmare.
Absolutely.
So,
it's so lonely for those poor kids.
It is. I have family in New Jersey specifically, and New Jersey has a very big Brazilian community, like many other places as well in the United States, but my family specifically in New Jersey. And the thing is, Americans, they there at least, they don't even really know what Brazil is. I remember I went to the United States once, and my cousin Danielle, he is Brazilian born in the United States. And he had just started college. So he took me to a college party. And I got to meet a lot of his fellow freshmen. And it was a very interesting experience when I told them. When I told one of them that I was Brazilian, he said, oh, my dad's been to Buenos Aires recently.
Not the same at all.
No, that's not. That city is in Argentina. That's not in Brazil.
Yes.
And my favorite thing that has ever happened was this guy who said, how are your chimichangas? Can you make chimichangas? And you see, I had no idea what that was.
Why would you?
Why? Because it's Mexican food. We don't really have that in Brazil,
right?
At all. And when we finally, because I didn't even know he was talking about food. I'm gonna be real with you, okay? I thought it was some very specific slang for boobs because he had his eyes on my boobs specifically as he said that. And I was like, I'm not sure what you're saying, but I think it's worth a slap.
I think so.
You know, so it took me a while. It took us a while to understand each other. And when I was like, oh, this is Mexican, actually. He was like, yeah, but you know, Brazil, Mexico is all kind of the same thing. And I was like, wow.
Right.
Not at all, actually. Like, we are not in the same hemisphere. We don't speak the same language. We don't have the same history. We weren't even colonized by the same people.
Right.
So, no.
We can't even say nice try for that guy because he didn't try at all.
Yeah, he didn't even try. Can't even give him that star. No, yeah.
Well,
but that's kind of the norm, you know, of what I faced there. There are a lot of funny stories, and some of them that are not funny at all.
Mm-hmm.
But I hope that with bringing Brazilian stories more to the mainstream, more to the center, we can, one, debunk some very strange myths, apparently, apparently there are about my country. And also, you know, tell a lot of Americans who maybe do not know Brazilians that, well, believe it or not, we are just like you.
Wow, who would have thought?
Who would have? Yeah, like surprise, surprise.
Well, I loved that you gave some of those examples that you just shared. You gave similar examples to Natalie in the book when we get to learn about that and sort of see how she grapples with American perceptions of what it means to be Brazilian versus the reality. Yeah. And we kind of watch her deal with language barriers within her family because she wants to speak Portuguese, but only knows a couple of words here and there, which I very much relate to. And we kind of watch her as she's figuring out who she is, not just as a Brazilian American, but as a Latina and an American in general. And what does she want to do? And what does that look like in Hollywood? And sort of where does she fit in? So I was hoping you could talk to me a little bit more about all of that, since I think it will resonate with a lot of people, not just folks who are Brazilian American, but the language barriers, I think, are so interesting to talk about and think about, especially for a lot of second generation Americans who maybe have parents who still speak the native language and now they don't so much speak it. And so I want to hear all your thoughts.
Thank you. Thank you for getting it, I guess. I really wanted to explore Brazilian culture through Natalie, who becomes Nachi.
That's
a Brazilian nickname. And I wanted to show that culture is not a fixed thing. Mm-hmm. It's evolving and it goes on without you if you don't pay attention to it. It goes on without you. And I wanted that to be something she struggled with because it can be very alienating mm-hmm. to feel that your culture, your family, it has moved on without you and you are behind and you want to catch up. You want that. But at the same time, you're like, you know, because I don't want to say that this is the universal experience, but in my character experience, she knows she's tried to bury those parts of her, mm-hmm. to fit in more, to assimilate to American culture. Not because she thinks being Brazilian is bad, but because she was told repeatedly that being Brazilian is bad. So I wanted to explore that because I think that this is something that everyone from the global South or descendant of people from the global South experiences to some extent, not only Latinx folks, but South Asian folks, but African folks. When you are just trying to fit in and stand out, which I think is a very teenage experience, you want to fit in and you want to stand out and you want to reconcile those things with being true to who you are, but you don't know who you are yet. Mm-hmm. So it's a struggle. It's a constant struggle. And I wanted to highlight that while also showcasing the variety of Brazilian experiences because Nachi is from, her family is from São Paulo, but you know, her best friend is from Recife. Her family is from Recife. And you know, she gets to meet girls from Ceará. There's a plurality of ways in which you can be Latinx.
Yes.
There's a plurality of ways in which you can be Brazilian. There's a variety of ways in which you can be. And I wanted to really explore how there's no wrong way to do it. You know, you have to find your way and your way will be right, regardless of how that is, but it is a painful process. Anyway, it is a painful process. Right. I have experienced especially with my cousins who were born abroad. I also have an aunt who went to London. Mm-hmm. And so she has had children and they were born in London and they are second gen Brazilians and they do not speak Portuguese. And I remember talking to this one cousin I have. He's a little younger than me. He's in his early 20s now. Mm-hmm. And I remember one time they came to Brazil and he wanted to talk to our grandma, but he couldn't. They couldn't understand each other. Mm-hmm. And he just got so angry. He got so angry and he just stormed out. And I found him like, he literally went to the middle of the street and sat there. And he was so angry. And I sat there with him. And because I speak English, and I'm basically the only other cousin who speaks English, I sat there with him and I tried to talk to him. And he just started crying.
Oh.
I had never seen anyone cry like this. And he said, I love this woman, our grandma. I love this woman, but I don't know how to tell her that. And I don't think she knows who I am because I can't tell her who I am either. Right. And he was a teenager when that happened. He was like 14. So I wanted to write this book for him too, for my cousins who may feel like they can say, I love you in Portuguese.
Oh my gosh, I love that. And honestly, as somebody who doesn't speak Spanish, is Puerto Rican and has felt very similarly, I really, really related to everything she was feeling. She just wasn't feeling like she could connect with her family and her roots the way that she so deeply wanted to. And I think a lot of people are going to read this book and say, this is a part of me. And you get it. I think so. So you mentioned some of Nachi's friends. So I want to talk about the friendships in this book because I think they're so, so fun to read. They're all supportive of each other. And I love the playfulness that you included between all of the friends. So why was it important for you to show us these friendships and these friends throughout the book?
Because I didn't have those friends. I was, when I was Nachi's age, my closest friends were not, they tried their best, but I was in very abusive relationships.
Oh.
And I didn't know friends could be supportive. Mm-hmm. I didn't know friends could really have your back. I thought they just didn't exist because the people I had around me, they were people that were constantly rooting against me. I thought that was the norm. And when I grew up a bit, when I learned to love myself a bit, I started having friendships that were real and were supportive and were so loving.
Yeah.
And then I was like, oh, wait, that's normal, right? Not that thing I had. It's funny because we were talking before about extraordinary author Adiba Jaggardar.
Yes.
I adore her, and she's a close friend of mine. And every now and then Adiba says something or does something and I'm like, wow, you were such a good friend. And she's like, Gabby, this is very normal. I did not do anything that impressive. That was like not like just mm-hmm. Your standards are very low. So this is why I wanted to include Padma and Brenda mm-hmm. in that way specifically, because I didn't come to have friends who loved me that much until I was older. And that's not okay. I want kids to read this book and see those friendships. And if they are in the situation I was in, ask themselves, why are my friends not like this? Shouldn't I have friends like this as well? Mm-hmm. Because, yeah, dude, you should. Right. Dump those toxic friends. You know, get better friends.
Exactly. They're such friendship goals. So anyone who picks this book up, your friends better treat you like Padma or Brenda, or they gotta go.
Yeah, making fun of you included, because you also you need to befriend people that can feel comfortable calling you out when you are being, you know, not great.
Exactly. You want friends who are honest with you. You don't want fake friends.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk love, since that's this mm-hmm. what this book is about. It's a rom-com. I mean, there's just so many threads though that are delightful. So there are tons of sweet and swoon-worthy scenes in this book between Nachi and William. And I adored just watching them grow from strangers into kind of rivals a little bit, and then friends, and then something more. So without spoiling too much, what was maybe one of your favorite scenes or exchanges to write between the two of them?
So my favorite scene ever is a spoiler. So I'll just say the scene at the beach.
Okay. Oh, I love that scene so much. Okay,
that one?
Yes, that one. The best.
But without spoilers, I really like their first encounter as, you know, people who are fake dating, because it's not the first time they meet. The mm-hmm. first time they meet is at the award show, in which Nachi gets humiliated.
Yeah.
But then their next encounter, which is their official first date, Nachi is very nervous, and she's like, "I don't like this, and mm-hmm. I don't want this." And like you said, it's a little bit like dislike to friends to lovers. And when he appears, he covers her eyes as a surprise, mm-hmm. because he's trying to be cute for the photographers, but she's so, you know, she jumps and she slaps his hands and she's like, "What are you doing?" So I love that. And he's like, "Okay,
I guess we're not playing together."
Like, exactly. So I really like that first scene. I had a lot of fun writing that first exchange. First, that is not first.
I thought it was perfect. And selfishly, I also loved when we watched them sort of go on a fake date to the red carpet, and there is a little tension, but then it kind of resolves, and I won't give more away, but I just thought that was very, very sweet. And I loved that too.
I had a lot of fun writing all the red carpet moments as well. I did a lot of research.
I was going to say, what research did you have to do for that?
Oh God, I did so many research. My agent was fantastic about it, because the level of detail that went into planning this book and into doing the first few drafts, my editor, my agent, Chelsea, she sent me lists of PDFs of catering buffets, of places that like serve Hollywood events.
Mm-hmm.
She went after that for me.
That level of detail. Got it.
Because on my first draft, the draft that got me my agent, I mentioned stuff like finger food. And she's like, "You can't say finger food. You have to be more specific than that."
Right.
You know, this kind of parties, they have themes. It's mm-hmm. not, it's not like that. You have to be way more specific. So, you know, I studied those PDFs. I read a lot of interviews and memoirs of celebrities talking about like how they're, you know, the backstage kind of stuff. There's a lot of things I didn't even use in the book, but served to inform me. Like, for example, did you know that typically celebrities, they don't come and go through the normal airports? Like, there are pickup points a few kilometers away just for celebrities. So they take a bus from those pickup points to the plane, so they don't have to stay at the airport with everybody else.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I wrote a couple of scenes that didn't make it to the book that were involving this dynamic, which I thought was so much fun. Mm-hmm. So there's all of this, you know, like there's an app that is a paid app, but it shows you just comments and likes, etc., from verified accounts. So you don't accidentally miss it when, you know, a friend, a celebrity friend likes or comments something, because you are, you know, inundated in fan comments.
Wow.
So all of these things I found out to do a lot about how the PR relationships go with celebrities as well. I found all of that reading, consuming a lot of celebrity memoirs and biographies, and it was a lot of fun, actually. It was a lot of fun.
It sounds like it. Now I kind of want to research this just for fun.
Yeah, it's great, you know, and also a lot of one thing that I guess I kind of expected, but it was a trip to read about. Mm-hmm. No matter how famous the celebrity, how you think they are, you know, just so perfect, they do not think so. The most stunning and richest celebrities are some of the ones with the lowest self-esteem.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, we're all just still people at the end of the day, right?
Exactly.
We all battle our demons and yeah. Money helps though.
It does. It does. I don't want to say that money couldn't solve a lot of problems for, you know, the global population. But I will say that it was interesting to see that past a certain point, it doesn't matter how much money you have or how many mm-hmm. connections you have. There is a point, though, we have to reach for people to be able to live comfortably and decently and have their needs met. But past that, it doesn't matter that much. No.
There have been studies that have said it's much lower than we think it is, the money threshold. Yeah. And as long as we're comfortable, right, in all of these areas, then suddenly we're all just the same. And it's not like if you have more money than that, you're not going to be happier necessarily. You're still going to have those same fears and insecurities.
I wanted to touch briefly, it's not a big theme on the book, but hopefully it's something you can pick up on, how superficial a lot of relationships between celebrities are. Mm-hmm. Because one thing that I picked from reading all of these books is that usually the best friends of those people are, like, for Natalie, you know, Brenda, who she met when she was not famous.
Yep.
Because after that, it's very difficult to trust people, because people will turn on you repeatedly. Mm-hmm. There's a part, it's just one paragraph, but I mentioned that Natalie learned not to trust people when she told, I think it was a stylist that she considered a friend, and she told her that she had a crush on, like, this other celebrity, and it became like a thing mm-hmm. that people discussed and stuff. And I wanted to touch on that briefly, like how lonely it can be in a position of so much glamour, you know, like the other side.
Right. I can see how celebrities would just want to stick to the people who they knew before and not necessarily branch out and meet people after, because it's scary to put yourself out there. You just don't know.
Don't you feel scared even now, like as an author, opposed this when you were a querying author?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I'm not anybody like famous. I just, you know.
Yeah, just because you have more visibility, you have enough visibility that others can take advantage of you.
Exactly.
So it's more difficult. Yeah. When I was a querying author, I would befriend literally everyone that looked my way. I would corner people with friendship. Okay. Like I was so easy to befriend. And now I am much more cautious because I have had a lot of people turn on me. Mm-hmm. And like you said, like we are not even celebrities. Like
nope.
I have 2,000 followers on Twitter. Like I'm not anything like, you know, nobody is using my face as their picture on Twitter. That would be very creepy though. Like
that would be really weird.
My cover, yeah, that's awesome. Like go nuts with characters. But me, that's weird. I'm not a celebrity. And I wouldn't want to be. Like, I think that's my biggest takeaway from all of this. I do not want that life.
I agree. I'm kind of Team William on that. Like, I don't want to be a celebrity.
And you know what? I think that this is something they should be able to choose. Mm-hmm. You know, like for people who haven't read the book yet. The love interest, William, he's not down with celebrity culture, but he loves acting.
Right.
And I agree. I think that acting isn't acting like singing, you know, like they are arts. You should be able to fully invest yourself in art without having to give up on your privacy, sometimes even on your soul.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope more artists can feel comfortable completely denying social media. I love that. The other day I saw something about how Lorde, her Twitter account was deleted for lack of activity.
That is goals. Like we,
yeah, I was like, wish it were me, but couldn't.
Right? I'm addicted, but I'm also wish I wasn't so addicted, you know?
Yes, sure, for sure. I think that's brilliant, you know? That's brilliant. You know, her account was deleted because she just doesn't use it at all. That's fantastic. I wish this could be something that all of us creative could feel more comfortable in, just giving up the societal pressure to showcase every aspect of our personality and personal lives.
Right.
And just do our art, just commercialize our art. This is the thing we are profiting off of, our art, not our bodies, not our souls, not our private lives.
Okay. Now I just want you to go out and say that to everybody and make this a reality, because I totally agree. There was a time when even authors like us didn't have to be on social media. And sometimes it feels like a lot of pressure that you have to be there or you'll miss out on something, or
definitely
insert whatever here.
I mentioned Adiba before. I remember the other day we were talking about how much neither of us really likes being on Twitter, but we are still on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, I can't wait for the time when I am so famous and so comfortable with my book sales that I will become updates only.
I love that.
You know what she said? She said, you will never feel that way, because best-selling authors, they think they have to be online all the time.
It's true.
You know, like Angie Thomas, she's been on the best-selling list ever since she debuted it. And she's still on social media.
You know? I know. Oh, Adiba, so, you're so smart.
She is. She's a lot smarter than me. I listen to, like, every time she says something, I'm like, oh my God, nugget of wisdom. Okay.
Just take that and put that in my pocket for later.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Okay. So we've talked about a lot of themes and just so much, I feel like, excellent points and like just so much going on in this book. So if you had to just quickly and succinctly tell somebody what you hope they take away from this book, what would you say? What do you want readers to walk away reading like a love song and feeling or thinking?
That you belong. That's truly my biggest mission in life, I think. To make sure kids specifically don't go through what I did, don't suffer the way I have. If I can stop that or make it less unbearable, I will know that I've done what I came here to do.
Oh, and I really do think you accomplished that in this book. So I can't wait for people to read it.
Thank you. I hope so.
Okay. So last big question, any future projects that you want to talk about or that you can share some info with us on?
Yes. My next YA rom-com is called Bad at Love, and it comes out summer 2022. Yay. It features another client of Bobby. Bobby is Nach's agent. Mm-hmm. So it features another one of her clients, and there are some fun Easter eggs for people who enjoy reading like a love song. It's not a sequel, it's a completely different story, but it's in the same universe. So some of the characters might be making an appearance.
I cannot wait. Oh, I'm so excited. Summer 22 better get here really fast.
It better take a while, because I'm still editing that
one. All right.
I think it's time. It's fine. It's fine.
Okay, I won't rush it. Okay, so now where can people find you on social media and online?
I am at Gabby Martins with BH on Twitter. On Instagram, I'm just Gabby, G-A-B-H-I. And my website is GabriellaWrites.com.
And go follow her because she's amazing and you get to see adorable pictures of her cats. So yes, highly recommend. Yes.
They made an appearance during this conversation.
And my heart just swelled. It was so cute.
I could tell Crystal was like, I have to keep talking about the serious thing. And they just like removed semen from my lap.
I know. It was so hard to keep a straight face and not be like, oh my God.
Yeah, I noticed she has that effect on people, to be fair. Yeah.
Oh, totally. All right. Thank you so much for chatting with me today.
Thank you.
Yay. I'm so excited for the world to read Like a Love Song, which is out August 3rd. I loved these characters and I think everyone else will too. Oh, you're welcome. If you'd like to learn more about Las Musas or our books, please visit our website at lasmusas.com or find us on social media at Las Musas Books. Be sure to check out our bookshop page where each purchase of our books goes towards supporting independent bookstores. If you enjoyed this episode, please like, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to your podcast. You can also sign up for the Las Musas newsletter to have podcast updates as well as other Musa news such as release dates, teasers, spotlights, and more delivered straight to your inbox. Thanks for listening.